This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. The ISIS-inspired terrorist from Uzbekistan who rammed that truck into New York pedestrians and bikers several days ago, killing eight of them and injuring many more, apparently caught his own family off guard. Because NBC is reporting that his sister says his family is shocked and her brother never expressed extremist views to any of them. So we hear a lot of that after these sorts of attacks, don't we? But we also hear something else even more often, and that is if you draw any conclusions at all from that jihad attack about Islam or about Islamic terror, then you are an Islamophobe. The problem is that if we can't talk openly about jihad terror, how are we ever going to adequately and intelligently deal with it? My next guest says Islamophobia is actually killing the free world. So what should we do? We're going to talk now with Robert Spencer, who is author and columnist and Islamic expert, director of Jihad Watch, a program of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And he is here to talk about his latest book called Confessions of an Islamophobe. And Robert, it's so good to welcome you back. How are you?
Oh, just great, Janet. Always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, you are the ultimate Islamophobe, wouldn't you say? I mean, you're right up there at the top.
Yeah, I always figure, certainly, in the lists that Islamic and leftist groups put out of Islamophobes. And, of course, the whole idea is to embarrass people and to shame them and to make people intimidate other people into thinking, I better not speak out against jihad terror. I better not say anything about even suspicious activity that I may see, because then people will call me an Islamophobe and I might lose my job and I'll be ridiculed in the press and everything will go wrong.
Right. But that's the idea. That's exactly why they do it.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly it. It's a tool. The whole idea of Islamophobia is a tool to intimidate people into thinking it's wrong to oppose jihad terror. And it works great. I mean, even just with this last massacre in New York City that you just mentioned, and the neighbors once again, they said, yes, they saw suspicious activity. And they were not challenged in the press, of course, as to why they didn't report it. But the answer is really obvious. They didn't report it because they knew what would happen if they did report it,
right?
That they would be accused of bigotry and racism and so on. You can just imagine, Saifullah Saipov, the killer in New York City, who drove a truck onto a bike path and killed eight people, he rented the truck from Home Depot. Now, he comes in, he's got the long Wahhabi beard, he looks like a whole lot of other terrorists. And I do wonder if the clerk at Home Depot thought, maybe this guy is up to no good and I better not rent him a truck. I'm sure that if that thought did flash across his or her mind, then the next thought was, but if I refuse to rent this guy a truck, I'll be accused of Islamophobia. I could lose my job. It could be even worse than that. I could be on the evening news.
That's true. And the same thing happened in San Bernardino. You had people who suspected those killers there and didn't say anything.
Yeah. Absolutely, Janet. The neighbors of the killers, Syed Rizwan Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, there, they were interviewed after the killing. And they said, yes, we saw all sorts of unsavory people going in and out and goings on happening all hours of the night. We were very concerned and very suspicious. Did you call the police? No, they said, because we didn't want to be accused of racial profiling. Same thing.
Well, talk a little bit, if you would, Robert, about the origins of this term Islamophobia and specifically the Muslim Brotherhood. A lot of people don't even know. They think this is just kind of a new term that's been coined maybe in the media or what have you. But where did it really come from?
It comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, as you say, specifically the International Institute of Islamic Thought, which is a Muslim Brotherhood organization, not very well known, but quite active in the United States and connected to all the major Muslim groups in the United States that people may have heard of, like the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, and so on. And they had a meeting in the 90s where they decided to use the term Islamophobia in the same way that gay rights groups had used the term homophobia to kind of wrongfoot the opposition, to intimidate people and to make people think that there's some pathology involved here, that it's that there are people who are sort of unbalanced and it's wrong to have any concern about jihad terrorism. And the whole idea is to silence and demonize and stigmatize and marginalize all opponents so that the jihad can advance unopposed and unimpeded.
Good grief. So if I'm remembering correctly from your book, wasn't it Ibrahim Hooper from CARE who first called you an Islamophobe? Was he the first one?
Yeah, that was on a show in MSNBC way back in 2002 or 3. And Keith Olbermann was the host. And yeah, I was sort of dumbfounded, actually, Janet, because I had just finished explaining that a Muslim, Sheikh Mohammed Hisham Kabbani, had toured 114 mosques in the United States in 1998. And then he testified before a State Department open forum in January 1999 that 80% of the mosques, based on his examination of the literature that they had and his interviews with the people in them, 80% of the mosques were teaching hatred of Jews and Christians and the necessity ultimately to replace the Constitution with Islamic law. This was testimony before the State Department. So I laid all that out. And then Olbermann went to Hooper, and Hooper asked, and Hooper just said, oh, Spencer is just a hate monger and an Islamophobe. And I was sort of shocked because I thought, well, he obviously did not answer my points. Nobody's going to fall for that. But actually, it's been a very effective tactic, such that most places that hold have speakers, they would never dare have a speaker who's listed as an Islamophobe by the Southern Poverty Law Center or by the Anti-Defamation League. They wouldn't dare. These people are toxic, and it is the enablers of jihad terror who want it to go ahead, who have made us toxic.
Yeah, it's so awful. And he's a terrible email spammer, too. I just have to throw that in because I'm trying to get him to stop emailing me all the time. It drives me nuts. But what about this point you've made that Islamophobia is killing the free world? It's obviously true, but what do you see from your vantage point?
Well, what I mean by that is this. You say, for example, you take the immigration crisis in Germany, and it just came to light recently that one of the plotters who was recently arrested, probably most people don't even know that there was a major plot thwarted in Germany just recently, and one of the plotters is a teenage boy, Muslim boy, who came into Germany as a refugee, and he was not vetted at all. Nobody checked anything about him. And if anybody had said, wait a minute, we can't do this, we have to have more stringent controls on immigration, of course, people would have said, well, you're just xenophobic, you're Islamophobic, you're bigoted and racist. And the broad-minded people, the right-minded people, the intelligentsia, we are standing against this Islamophobia and hatred. And so we're not going to have checks on people who are coming in as refugees. That's just one thing. Another one, a news item coming out of Minnesota, that recently there was a speaker, Usama Dakdak, who is a Coptic Christian,
yes,
who grew up in Egypt, and he knows firsthand the Muslim persecution of Christians. He was going to speak in Minnesota, and the venue, they actually canceled his appearance because they were afraid of charges of Islamophobia. And after that, it gets even worse because one of the organizers of the event worked at an organization called the Ironwood Springs Christian Ranch in Minnesota. And he was actually fired when his bosses found out that he had helped organize this event. And you think, well, what on earth is wrong? The event was called Exposing Sharia. And, you know, Sharia denies the freedom of speech, denies the freedom of conscience, mandates the death penalty for leaving Islam. It devalues a woman's testimony and inheritance rights. It calls for the beating of women from whom men, quote, fear disobedience. That's what the Quran says. It institutionalizes discrimination against non-Muslims. It stipulates that Muslim lives are worth more than non-Muslim lives, and on and on and on. But opposing that is so terrible to these Christians in Minnesota that they fired the organizers. This is the power of the fear of Islamophobia. And I could go on and on and on. There was an imam in Toronto recently who prayed that Allah would count all the Jews and kill them down to the last one. And instead of there being some sort of a large-scale investigation of Islamic anti-Semitism and its spread in Canada, the Toronto Star put out a big story about how the imam was really a nice guy and he didn't really mean that. And properly translated, he didn't even really say that, which was false. And anybody who opposes him is some terrible Islamophobe. And this is, you take all these stories, and I could, as I say, I could go on and on and on, but you take all this cumulatively, and what you have is Western leaders all over Western Europe and the United States and Canada who are afraid to stand up against jihad terror and this preaching of violence and hatred for fear of being called Islamophobic.
Yeah, it's really a disease. We're going to go to a break. We'll be back with Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch and author of Confessions of an Islamophobe. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
Believe it or not, the United Nations has earmarked millions of dollars for Palestinian efforts to pursue international legal action against Israel over the next several years. The UN said it will also strengthen its own advocacy on the impact of Israeli violations. Both President Trump and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley have shown steadfast support for Israel, and we are grateful to them. I was able to thank the President personally for his support for Israel at a dinner I attended with him recently. But you and I must join in our support through much-needed prayer efforts and also by calling our congressmen and asking them to stand boldly for Israel against those who openly seek her destruction.
Join us on the front lines. Fight to defend critical issues like support for Israel and religious freedom. Together, we'll bring biblical constitutional values back to our nation. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to give today. That's CapitolHillBrief.org. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is Anne's story.
I had numerous credit cards and I was struggling with paying them off. I had heard about Trinity, so I made the call. They took care of all of my credit cards and now I am completely debt free. The people at Trinity are very friendly. They will do whatever you need them to do in order for you to feel better about being in a very difficult place. My name is Anne, and thanks to Trinity, I'm debt free for keeps.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your account, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. There is hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. We are back on Janet Mefford today. My guest is Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch and author of Confessions of an Islamophobe. And what an important book at an important time. It seems every week or so we hear about another terror attack or another gang rape of some girl in Europe or something crazy going on in Canada. And Robert is really exposing this Islamophobia lie for what it is and is making the case very well that it's killing the free world. One of the things that you mentioned before we went to the break here, Robert, was the fact that you had had this cancellation of this Exposing Sharia event, and then this Christian center fired the man for helping stage it. Now, one of the things that is striking to me, and you've got a whole chapter on the threat to Christians, is the fact that we are seeing increasingly these stories where Christians are being so ignorant of what the threat is. You had featured a story just recently about Sinclair Ferguson, who I actually know, and I've interviewed him a number of times, making this comment at this Ligonier Ministries gathering that the greatest threat to Christendom is Christianity, and it's a greater threat than Islam. And I almost fell off my chair when I saw him say that, but it's not, I mean, I'm seeing more and more of this.
Yes, absolutely. It's sort of pandemic among Christians of all denominations to disregard and dismiss the idea that Islam poses any threat to Christianity or that there is any reason for concern. And Christians have been among the most energetic purveyors of the idea that any concern about jihad terror is just Islamophobia, as I show in the book and detailing some interactions I've had with some bishops and others. Yeah. And the fact is that if you just look at the history of the world, there were thriving Christian communities in North Africa and the Middle East, Egypt, Syria. They're the heart of the Islamic world now, but they were Christian for hundreds of years before they were invaded and conquered and Islamized. And the reality is that the Western world is not immune from that. The same thing could happen here. It's not going to happen in the same way with invading armies, but it may happen precisely by means of the refugee influx that Christian groups have so energetically been in favor of, even though it's bringing in massive numbers of Muslim migrants, among whom are an unknowable number of jihad terrorists. The Islamic State, ISIS, they vowed several years ago to infiltrate the refugee stream. They have done it. You can see that from the fact that in November 2015, there were 130 people in Paris murdered by eight Islamic jihadis, and all eight of them had just come into Europe as refugees. Tashfeen Malik, the San Bernardino shooter who we were discussing before, she was a refugee. She had actually passed five separate background checks from five different U.S. agencies, which shows you how good this vetting is.
Right.
And so we are bringing upon ourselves a massive problem that is going to be a problem that our children and our children's children are going to have to deal with. And the Christian churches are aiding and abetting this problem instead of moving to protect the Christians who are in the West.
It's horrible. And I think a lot of them are really of the mindset that what you really need are more bridge initiatives, more interfaith dialogue, more coming together, you know, that tri-faith initiative in Omaha, these sorts of things. If we're just really, really nice to them, then we can all just live in peace and safety. But is this just a wildly naive proposition when we see the case of Muslim majority countries around the world?
Oh, yeah. It's not only naive, it's paternalistic. It's sort of imperialistic and ethnocentric in an odd way, because what they're saying is that it's really all our fault. If Muslims are angry with us, it's because we haven't been nice enough to them.
Right.
And if we would just stop being mean to them and be nice to them, then all would be well, which looks upon Muslims as if they are the passive recipients of the activity of Western Christians, and have no agency of their own, no ability to think of their own, no priorities or perspectives of their own. They're just passive reactors to whatever the West does. Well, in reality, there is a jihad imperative that's in the Quran and in the teachings of Muhammad, and it's in Islamic law to make war against the Christians, whether they're nice to you or not,
yeah,
and to conquer and subjugate them, whether they're nice to you or not. And it's the refusal of Christian leaders from the Pope on down, and Christians who are Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox, who do not recognize that this is an imperative within Islam, and thus are pursuing dangerously naive and self-defeating courses of so-called dialogue that are only making it even harder to defend the Christians in the Middle East and to alert the Christians in the West to what's happening.
Yeah, it's so true. But whenever you bring up some of these arguments with Christians, at least this has been my experience, what you get is you shouldn't fear the Muslim population. You're just assuming that everybody is a potential jihadist. How do you deal with some of those comebacks that we hear from well-meaning people who are just not informed?
Well, you know, I think it's a funny thing, Janet, that fear has become this bad word.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, fear, if it's some sort of a paralyzing thing, is certainly something that we should all reject. In the face of a threat, we shouldn't have fear. We should have resolve to deal with the threat. But fear, in a certain sense, is simply a mature recognition of the fact that there is a threat coming from somewhere. But
right
now, we're told all the time in the mainstream media, like, for example, recently after this attack in New York City, the truck jihadi, he screamed Allahu Akbar as he's mowing down people on the street. And so all these articles came out saying we shouldn't fear Allahu Akbar and we have to fight to overcome fear. And I think, well, this is ridiculous. If I am in a shopping mall or in an airplane and somebody screams Allahu Akbar, I'm going to be afraid and try to get out of there,
right,
so that I don't get blown up.
Right.
And that's not a fear that anybody prudently should reject. But in any case, this is what we're being sold, that fear in itself, in any of its forms, is bad.
Well,
and
yep,
that we should work to just have no defensive reflex at all.
No, you're right. And what comes to mind is one of the things that Jake Tapper said over on CNN, and I'm sure you heard this, where he was basically doing an apologetic for Allahu Akbar, often heard in just the most beautiful of moments. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? You wouldn't do that for any other religion.
That's right. Absolutely. And he was not the only one. It was on CNN. It was in the New York Times. It was in the New York Daily News. I wrote refutations of all of those pieces where there was leftist and Muslim spokesmen saying, look, Muslims say Allahu Akbar when babies are born. Muslims say Allahu Akbar when they have a good meal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As if that means that Muslims don't scream Allahu Akbar when they're murdering infidels.
Right.
In reality, Allahu Akbar means Allah is greater, greater than your God, greater than anything else. And so when it is said in the context of a jihad attack, it is said in order to strike terror in the hearts of the infidels. Mohammed Atta, the 9/11 hijacker, said that explicitly. And so we would be stupid to discount that just because Muslims say it in other contexts.
Yeah, that's a great point. You talk about the threats to varying groups. You talk about the threat to women and the threat to homosexuals and the threat to Jews especially. And this one really grabs me because, as you mentioned, Jews are threatened in Europe today in a way that we haven't seen since the days of the Nazis. And yet you have groups like the Anti-Defamation League attacking you, like you're the bad guy. You shouldn't be saying what you're saying. Well, shouldn't you be their best friend?
Yeah, one would think. And it seems as if they're more concerned about maintaining their leftist credentials than they are about actually protecting Jews in the 21st century.
Yes.
It's the same thing when Pamela Geller and I were banned from entering Britain in 2013. And because Pamela Geller is Jewish, they asked the Board of Deputies of British Jews if they had any objection to our being banned. And they said, oh, no, they didn't like any of this bigotry and Islamophobia any more than anybody else. And I think, okay, how far do we have to go with this rejection of so-called bigotry and Islamophobia? How far is the left really going to go with this? Are they going to, while the machete is slicing through their neck, are they going to be thinking, isn't it wonderful that I was never bigoted? Or at a certain point, are they going to stand up and say, you can call me bigoted, but I'm going to resist jihad terror at this point?
Yeah. Do you think that there is any tipping point at which people will push back against the Islamophobia myth that the media is so intent upon pushing on us via their associations with groups like CARE and activists like Linda Sarsour?
Yeah, I think that it's happening now, as a matter of fact, and I hope that this book contributes to it, that people are awake, not all of them, of course, but many people are waking up to how this word is used to manipulate people and to scare them into silence over what is a genuine and real threat. And that's why, actually, in this book, I say, yes, I'm an Islamophobe, when I've said, no, I'm not an Islamophobe for years and years. What is at the heart of that is this. Islamophobia is a term, it's a vicious conflation of two different things. It's used for two different meanings. One is attacks by vigilantes, racist redneck yahoos on innocent Muslims. And of course, those, when they really happen, are never justified under any circumstances.
Right.
But Islamophobia is also used to refer to honest discussion of the motivating ideology behind jihad terror. And in that case, everybody has to be an Islamophobe.
Yes. Would it help, do you think, Robert, to have the administration designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, as Ted Cruz has called for, in order to marginalize groups like CARE?
That would be a massive help because, yes, CARE is a Muslim Brotherhood organization, and every major Muslim organization in the United States today is Muslim Brotherhood. And so if it were designated a terror organization, it would be much easier to go after these Islamic advocacy groups in the United States that have these Brotherhood ties, to go after their finances, to expose their propaganda, and ultimately to shut them down. The Obama administration itself shut down investigations of CARE that had been proceeding in 2009. Those need to be reopened.
Right. Well, and we saw this incident just recently where this man had gotten into the Miami airport. I'm sure you saw this, and got onto the tarmac. I mean, you know, we are not safe. I thought of that because of CARE getting its backdoor security tour over at O'Hare Airport and other places like that. I mean, just for the safety and security of Americans, I don't know why in the world people can't just agree that this is a threat to us and abandon their intersectionality in the face of such a threat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really amazing how everything has been turned topsy-turvy, such that you have airport officials a few years back at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, and they're giving CARE a tour of airport security procedures because they don't want CARE to think they're Islamophobic. And yet you have this is like giving the fox a tour of the hen house, because CARE is a Muslim Brotherhood organization. And so it was extraordinarily stupid and self-defeating for the O'Hare Airport officials. But they don't know that because the Islamophobia narrative is so dominant.
Absolutely. Which is why they need to read Confessions of an Islamophobe by Robert Spencer. Robert, thank you as always for being with us.
Pleasure, Janet. Thank you.
Thanks again. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters November 17th, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com. This hour of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation. The fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star in theaters November 17th, rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com. All right, we have more to talk about regarding Judge Roy Moore and what a big story this is turning out to be. So much to say, and I want to get to some of this audio that we've put together from Sean Hannity's show late Friday. This was very revealing. When it first came out, the denials that came out from Roy Moore about this Washington Post story accusing him of initiating a sexual encounter with a 14-year-old girl about 38 years ago, and then also having contact with other teenage girls, not of a sexual nature, but young teenage, they're older teenage girls. And he came out with a statement and he was denying it. And then he went on Sean Hannity's show and got into more detail. We're going to play that for you in just a second. But I find this to be absolutely telling. And I have seen so much like this. Now there are people, these companies that are pulling ads from Fox's Hannity show over the fact that he interviewed Roy Moore at all and told his listeners to give Roy Moore the benefit of the doubt. And there was this one tweet USA Today ran from a man who wrote to Keurig, Keurig, the coffee pod company and the coffee maker company that runs ads on Hannity's show. And this is what this tweeter said. Good afternoon, Keurig. You are currently sponsoring Sean Hannity's show. He defends child molester Roy Moore and attacks women who speak out against sexual harassment. Please reconsider. And Keurig writes back, thank you for your concern. We worked with our media partner and Fox News to stop our ad from airing on the Sean Hannity show. Now, did you catch what he said there, the guy who's writing to Keurig? Sean Hannity, he says, defends child molester Roy Moore. I've never seen such a blatant libel. You don't have any evidence that he's a child molester. You have accusations that have been lodged against Judge Roy Moore from one woman who was 14 years old, she claims, when Roy Moore was watching her outside the courthouse as her mother was inside the courthouse. And then they went out a few times. And at one point he did something inappropriate and she said, stop. And he said, okay. And he took her back home. This is one woman's story, but we don't have any court evidence. We don't have a jury having weighed in. We don't have a judge having weighed in. All we have is what this woman claims via the Washington Post. That's a whole nother story when you look at the Washington Post's own record within the last year of inaccurate stories and stories that were bombshells and turned out not to be true. So we can talk about journalistic credibility in the Washington Post. But it is important to hear what Judge Roy Moore had to say. I have been very much involved in the last several years on the issue of child sexual abuse. I care very much about this issue. I think there are a lot of victims of child sexual abuse, and it has been a very awful thing to talk to some families where this actually has occurred. I've talked to families who have had children who've been abused actually inside the church. So my radar are completely on board with people who come forward and share their stories of child sexual abuse. But each and every instance has to be taken individually. You can't just say because somebody lodges a complaint or an accusation, boom, you better believe them. Why is that? Because it might not be true. Even if 20 out of 21 of them are true, if you believe all 21 and one of them is false, then you end up saying, wow, well, we should cast a little bit askance glance there at any woman who comes forward because now we know some of them may be liars. It's a big problem. You have to take them one by one. So I want to turn to this audio so you can hear what Roy Moore had to say for himself. He responded regarding this Lee Korfman, the woman who was then 14 years old, when she says he was inappropriate with her. And Sean Hannity asks, do you know her and her mother? Cut one.
I don't know Ms. Korfman from anybody. I've never talked to her, never had any contact with her. Allegations of sexual misconduct with her are completely false. I believe they're politically motivated. I believe they're brought only to stop a very successful campaign, and that's what they're doing. I've never known this woman or anything.
Okay, pretty flat-out denial. I don't know her. I don't know her from anybody. It didn't happen. It's a false accusation. Then he's asked, would it have been unusual for you as a 32-year-old man at the time to date girls as young as 17 or 18? Do you remember dating girls that young at that time? Moore said he doesn't remember and doesn't remember going out with any girl without their mother's permission. And so Hannity asks, are you saying nothing that Lee Korfman is claiming ever happened? This is cut two.
It never happened, and I don't even like hearing it because it never happened. And they're doing this a month away, 4 weeks away, after 40 years in public service. I've run five successful campaigns, statewide campaigns, three in the county. This has never been brought up. It has never been even mentioned. And all of a sudden, 4 weeks out, they're bringing it up. They're bringing it up because it's political. It's a direct attack on this campaign, and it involves a 14-year-old girl, which I would have never had any contact with, nothing with her mother or in a courthouse or anywhere else would I have done that. In fact, her allegations contradict the whole behavior pattern that the two of the young ladies even witnessed herself.
Which is a true point, because some of those other women who are making accusations in the Washington Post story said that he did not do anything inappropriate and it never went beyond kissing. And that to me raises a little bit of a red flag, because generally speaking, when you have somebody who's a predator, they're not a gentleman in other situations. It sort of seems out of character if somebody really is a predator. I'm not trying to judge guilty or innocent here. I'm just trying to raise some responses to some of these things that he said. Then Hannity asks, if any Senate candidate had done what they claim you did to a 14-year-old girl, would you agree that that person should not serve in the Senate? Cut three.
Nobody that abuses a 14-year-old age 32 or age 17, it doesn't matter. If you abuse a 14-year-old, you shouldn't be a Senate candidate. I agree with that. But I did not do that.
And then Hannity asks Roy Moore, was it normal for you back then to date a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old? This was the judge's response. Cut four.
Would it be normal behavior back in those days for you to date a girl that's 17 or 18?
No, not normal.
If my daughter is 17, my daughter's 16 years old. If she's 17 or 18, I don't want her dating a 32-year-old.
I wouldn't either.
And you can say unequivocally you never dated anybody that was in their late teens like that when you were 32?
It would have been out of my customary behavior. That's right.
In other words, you don't recall ever dating any girl that young when you were that old?
I've said no.
And you think that's inappropriate, too? That's what you're saying?
Inappropriate, yes.
Okay. Now you've heard the lion's share of the main comments that Judge Moore has used to respond to these allegations that were in the Washington Post. Here's what it comes down to. You have all these people in the Rhino establishment wing of the GOP who are saying he should step down, he should step aside. Mitt Romney saying it doesn't really matter whether or not we have evidence or a jury or what have you, because that's just the criminal conviction standard. That's not the standard for having somebody represent the people of the state of Alabama. So he should step aside. John McCain of the same opinion. As I say, it's tough because if it really did happen, he really should step aside, of course. But you've got the New York Times yelling at people for even saying if it's true. You shouldn't say if it's true. Well, what in the world? You people are the same people who are defending Bill Clinton, for crying out loud, for years. You made all kinds of excuses for Bill Clinton and his wife, who was alleged to have gone after her bimbos, right? Her husband's bimbos that she called. That's what she called them. So have a standard and stick to it. Here's what I think in the final analysis needs to happen. We're not going to have a jury trial. We're not going to have any judge weighing in on this. It's he said, she said. I think the only thing you really can do is let the voters of Alabama decide. That's all you can do. It's too late to replace him on the ballot. It's too late to do anything about it. It's just a few weeks out from the election now. That's what you should do. That's really all you can do. Let the voters decide. If the voters in Alabama don't believe Roy Moore, they will not vote for him and he will not get into the Senate. If they do not believe the Washington Post, then they will elect him. And those numbers, as I understand it, are shrinking between Roy Moore and his opponents. So we'll see how it shakes out. But that's how, in my mind, that's the only way you really can solve it, is the people of Alabama will have to be the final judges on who they believe. We'll keep on top of this story for sure. We're going to come back right after this. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Did you know that you can help create the next great Christian missionary force? It's true. Right now in Lebanon, there are 2 million refugees living in tent settlements. They're the innocent victims of the brutal Syrian civil war, and more than half of them are children who are at great risk of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking. But in the midst of the darkness, Heart for Lebanon is offering the hope of the gospel. Through their hope centers, Heart for Lebanon is feeding these children, giving them a Christian education, and introducing them to Jesus for the very first time. Hearts are really open right now, and the Lord is changing their lives, but we need your help. Your gift of $22 will rescue 4 children. Your gift of $98 will rescue 18 children, an entire classroom full. Will you please help us help these children who will go home one day and reach their nations for Christ? Call now, 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187. There's also a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Please pray and please give. 866-485-9187.
Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation present The Star, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. Bo the donkey and his stable of animal friends follow the star to become some unlikely heroes.
That light, that's the star. This is where it's been leading me.
What's his name?
His name is Jesus.
The Star, in theaters November 17th. More information is available at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. We are back on Janet Mefford today. It's a terrible thing to have to even think about, but in light of the massacre at First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas last week, what do all of us need to know to keep ourselves and our families safe in the unlikely event of a mass shooting at our churches? We're going to tackle that today with John Matthews, founder of the Community Safety Institute and author of Mass Shootings, 6 Steps to Survival. John, it's great to have you here.
Well, thank you, Janet.
Well, you have studied mass shootings more than many of us, probably most of us have, and you've seen this over the years, what has transpired. What are your main takeaways regarding security when you look at this particular case in Sutherland Springs?
Well, you know, obviously this wasn't a first. As a matter of fact, we've had many, many mass shootings in churches over the years, the last big one being Charleston, of course. But churches are a soft target. People go there to pray, to worship, to be together as a family. And the last thing they're expecting is some type of violence like this. It's unfortunate, though, but we've got to be prepared. And I tell people, being prepared is not being paranoid. It's knowing the world we live in, knowing that there's evil in the world, and making sure that we can start a conversation with our family, with our congregation, to talk about issues like this and say, what are we doing to protect ourselves? How can we, you know, learn to not only protect ourselves, but protect our families so that we can enjoy going to our public gatherings, whether they be in workplaces, churches, or wherever they are.
Yeah, that's really smart. I see this in two different ways. One is some of the steps to survival that might be important in a situation like that, and then also guarding against this kind of attack in the event that it is going to happen and you could stop it in its tracks potentially by taking certain steps. But what about the steps to survival? When you look at what transpired, the doors were open. He came in. He had this rifle and he shot people. He went up and down the pews and shot people. It was so horrible. But what can you even do in a scenario like that? How would you advise people, if you're ever in a situation like that, what you can do to survive?
Well, as you know, Janet, we've studied every single mass shooting since 1980. And what we looked at specifically were the actions taken and decisions made by those that survived. And if you looked at the survivors and their stories from Sunday, it really aligns with what we talk about in the book. The first thing is to exit as quickly as possible. In that particular environment, there was only one entrance and another exit on the other side of the building. So people, as opposed to the Las Vegas shooting that was a huge area, they were confined in a very small building with only 2 exits. And so the first step is, if you are away from that shooter, continue to get away, move away as quickly as possible. If you're in the back, if you're back in those back rows of the pew, what you need to do next is to find cover. And if you look at some of the stories, that's exactly what they did. The pews were heavy. They were thick benches. They rolled under the benches. They found cover. Cover is anything that's going to stop bullets. And that's what you need in that situation. If you can't find cover, the next best thing to do, Janet, is to find concealment. And concealment is anything that'll keep you out of the line of sight of the shooter. We saw people said, I hid under other people. I hid and covered myself up. They concealed themselves out of the shooter's line of sight. And as he moved to the church, he basically moved past him. We see this in almost every single mass shooting. The shooter is fixated on a high body count, usually after they take care of what we call their primary target. They're just spraying bullets everywhere, trying to increase that body count, and they're not checking on the people that are in the facility. And if you do something like find cover, find concealment, even play dead, which someone did, those are excellent steps to survival. The last couple of things that we tell you is to constantly assess the situation. If he's reloading, if he's moving, if he's in another place in the church, go get away from him, exit again out of there as soon as you can. If you do that, present a small target. You know, stay low to the floor, move from object to object, make it as difficult on him as possible. And only in the rarest of circumstances does research say we should engage him, but that is the last step in the model that we call escape.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Is there ever a scenario in which you would advise somebody to either do a confrontation of the gunman or a distraction? In other words, standing up, trying to get his attention in order that other people can get out.
I mean, if you distract him, probably what's going to happen is you're going to be injured or killed. It may allow some other people to get out. Let me tell you what the research says. The research says, if this is for an untrained civilian, okay, that is faced with, you know, having to confront the suspect, so you have no other choice. Here's what the research says. Three or more people attacking simultaneously while the shooter is in the act of some non-shooting activity. That might be changing out weapons, changing magazines, reloading, moving locations, things like that. So that's what the research tells us from every shooting that we've studied over the last 40 years. If you have those conditions, then it gives you a chance to survive. Now, we did see this citizen engage the shooter. He had the element of surprise and the tactical advantage. We actually saw that move from the shooter who was exiting the building. He had completed his task, wasn't expecting to be engaged, and a citizen actually engaged him and gained the tactical advantage.
Yes, which was really good. Now, this is interesting. After you look at something like this and you talk about important things like you just did concerning the entrance and the exit, there weren't a lot of places in that particular building to get in and out. Presumably, they didn't have a security team. They're out in a rural area. How would you advise churches, not necessarily the mega churches, which in most cases these days will have some measure of professional security, but a church that's maybe 100 people, 200 people, what are some smart steps you can take to avoid a situation like this?
The first thing you can do is just do an honest assessment of your building, of your parishioners, of the resources that you have, and see if you can make your church a little more difficult, a little hardened target. We know that these mass shooters will look for soft targets. We saw them when they attacked the Amish school up in Pennsylvania, which was a soft target. And we've seen it over and over again. I remember the shooter in Los Angeles who actually went to three different locations until he found what he considered a soft target. So do an assessment and you know, try to determine, you know, where you might improve your security, cameras, greeters at the door, things like that. That may seem really simplistic, but we actually had a shooting stop because a greeter went up to a gunman. She didn't know he was a gunman at the time, shook his hand and said, "Hi, I'm glad you're here." The gunman said later, "Oh my gosh, she knows who I am. I can't do the shooting here. I got to leave."
Oh, wow.
So something as simple like that works. When we go out across the country, when we're talking to citizens, when we're training law enforcement, we talk about three steps: pre-planning, talking with your family, and talking with them in an age-appropriate manner to say something like, "Hey, mommy and daddy are going out. We're going to be together tonight. If something happens, I want you to listen to us." And we may have to play a game like hide and seek. We may have to be quiet for a while, but listen to me. Listen to mom and dad. We're going to take care of you. pre-planning is important. Situational awareness, being aware of your surroundings, knowing where those exits are, knowing where the entrances are, knowing where there's places to take cover or find concealment. Very, very important. And then again, the escape model is a six-step model. Really easy for people to learn, really easy to practice. And practice these scenarios, all of that is going to make you less of a target.
Would you advise churches, for example, this came up on my show a couple of days ago when we were talking about this, would you advise churches to lock their doors, for example, after the worship service starts so nobody can come in after the service begins? Because that's something churches worry about. We don't want anybody to feel unwelcome. What would you advise in that regard?
I can tell you that if you're in any structure and the shooter or potential shooter is outside the structure, and this applies to churches, church schools, office places, anytime you have an opportunity to lock down and put a barrier between you and the shooter, your chances for survival increase.
That's good to know. Right. Well, and this is maybe why churches are such soft targets, because we really want to be welcoming, but you do have to balance the welcoming with the potential danger. And a lot of churches, I think, feel, well, if we err too much on the side of not welcoming, then we may lose people coming to the church. How do you strike that balance between being welcoming and making sure that you're protecting people to the best of your ability?
I think it's communication. I think it's outreach. I think it's letting people know you want them to come to church, you want them to attend your service, that you want new worshipers to come. You know, so you're communicating that message via many, many different modalities all throughout the week. But it doesn't mean that when Sunday comes around or Wednesday night comes around that you can't say, all right, everyone's in here. We're going to, you know, lock the door. We're going to be secure. You know, I think I don't know people that might be turned away. You know, I think if you're constantly giving a message of come join us, come worship with us, be with us, I think that's going to be the biggest factor. And the other thing is, don't be afraid to provide training to your parishioners, to your congregation. That makes them feel like you care about them. I cannot tell you the places that we go into, and we'll spend an hour with a church group and providing training, and they'll be just like, oh my gosh, we can't believe you took time out. You really care about it. That's what they walk away with, and we're trying to get this training the same as CPR training. It's given to millions of people every year. Very few ever have to use it. We want to do the same thing. We want everyone to know this model. We want everyone to be able to practice it, and we hope they never, ever have to use it.
Good stuff. Well, we're out of time, but John Matthews from the Community Safety Institute, thank you so much for that good advice. We appreciate your being with us. Thanks for being with us here on Janet Mefford Today. God bless you. We'll see you next time.